nothing ever could. So somewhere right, in my
And we're going to lead off with our Pledge of Allegiance. Please join me.
Ladies and gentlemen, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, thank you. Ms. Gregory, will you do the roll call for us?
Yes, Chair Onen. Chair Onen?
Here.
Vice Chair Jenkins?
Here.
Commissioner Daniels?
Present.
Commissioner Fuller?
Present.
Commissioner Maynard?
Present.
Thank you.
All right, so at this point we have a public forum which gives anybody the opportunity to speak to any item that's not on our agenda this evening. I do not have any speaker slips.
I do not have any, Chair Onen.
All right, so that is the opening and the closing of the public forum. And let's move on. Are there any amendments or adjustments to the agenda this evening?
No, there are not.
All right, let's go on right to item A1, which is the approval of the minutes from our previous meeting. Did you want to read that into the record?
Yes, item A1 is the Planning Commission minutes for the Planning Commission meeting of February 23rd, 2015.
All right, any comments or changes on those?
No comments. I would like to move to approve the minutes.
Got a motion? Second?
Second.
All right, so we have a motion and a second. Is there any other comments on the minutes? Everybody's read them through. All right, all those in favor say aye.
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 Looks like that's unanimous. So we'll move right on to item B1. And Ms. Wells, are you leading this?
Good evening, Chair Onen and commissioners. Before I turn the presentation over to Chandra Slavin, who's a senior planner in advanced planning, I'm going to give you a little bit of context and introduce our team. A long time ago, which is nice to say, when we were preparing our general plan, we were assessing things like flood hazards and fire hazards and shoreline hazards and oil and gas industry hazards along our coastline and things like that, and then writing policies in our general plan that would address those kinds of hazards, and then policies, overarching policies that were trying to balance or attempting to balance how future growth could be balanced with protection of sensitive habitats, for example, and also fire and drought and shoreline hazards and things like that. At the time, the science of sea level rise wasn't really getting down to the planning level in a general plan. Things are different today. And as we are now preparing our local coastal program for the Coastal Commission, well, it's for us, it's for our community, we are now updating our general plan so that it can reflect the science as it is today. And although our shoreline is not such a great extent, it is very important to our community. It really does define partially our character of our community. So when we embarked on this journey to do our local coastal program, we brought on board a really important person, somebody whose name has been always brought up in the science journals, and that's Dr. Dave Revelle, who's sitting here to my left. So he is on our team from the science perspective. We have Chandra Slavin, who is an adaptive management type planner. She does coastal planning. She did our climate plan, and that's her background. And then we also have Jane Ballard, who is our intern for the past year. She's in the audience. And she is going to the Bren School as a graduate student. And she's doing a lot of data collection. And so I don't want to underscore the fact that she has invested a lot of time behind the scenes in helping us doing a lot of research. And with that kind of context, I'm going to turn over the presentation to Chandra. Thank you.
Good evening, Chair, fellow commissioners. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here before you again this evening. to talk about sea level rise, coastal hazards more in depth, as well as the planning tools, both policies and regulations, to address sea level rise and coastal hazards in the context of our local coastal program. So to begin with, I'm going to go through a brief background kind of refresher to pick up where we left off from our last presentation to you as well as the City Council on this topic, and then we'll dive right into the planning and regulatory tools, which I love, and both land use policies and zoning regulations. So, and I know you, being a planning commission, will really appreciate it. And then from there, we'll talk about next steps for the local coastal program. So, our background and refresher, first off, this is the city of Goleta. No, this is the coastal zone, hatched in, I guess that's pink. So as you can see, the majority of our coastal zone, again, is to the left side, if we're looking at this. And then we have patches kind of spread throughout. So we have Stork Ranch, and then we have pieces of Old Town and so on. So that is our coastal zone. And like we discussed last time, not a whole lot of the city actually lies in the coastal zone itself. But that's not to say that this isn't incredibly important in terms of going forward with having a certified local coastal program. Again, just to refresh your memory, we do not have a certified LCP at this time, but we have every intention of getting this certified per our grant with the Coastal Commission. So let's talk about some of Goleta's coastal hazards. A lot of these hazards obviously go beyond the coastal zone, and you're probably pretty familiar with these. But for purposes of tonight's presentation, for the LCP, we're just focusing on coastal hazards. So the first one being beach erosion, sea level rise, and subsistence of land. And a lot of this we can capture in our local coastal program, both the land use plan and implementation plan. Another hazard is fire. It's pretty significant. And right now we do have an adopted community wildfire protection plan, which we can talk about if you have any questions. And then, of course, the drought. We're reading about that every day now. It's pretty serious. And as of April 1st, we actually have an executive order from the governor for mandatory 25% water conservation. And then beyond that, we have, as if that's not enough to handle, we have flood inundation and storm damage as another coastal hazard. And if you all recall the March 2014 storm that took out some of the pier and actually damaged some of our habitat in our jurisdiction, and then we have the resulting coastal hazards cleanup project that we did in collaboration, actually, with the State Lands Commission, where a significant number of safety issues from remnant oil and gas and so on were removed. So we've got a lot going on in our coastal area. So to address this, this is Goleta's approach. We have already completed a backshore characterization analysis, which we'll give you a little refresher course on. And then next steps are the vulnerability assessment, which we're going to start hopefully in May, June. And then from there, we're going to develop actual adaptation policies and regulations based on the Goleta-specific vulnerability assessment. And then from there, we're going to submit our LCP application targeted for April 2016. Not this month, a year from now. So, a quick reminder of the work already completed by our team. The first one is the backshore characterization analysis that covers a variety of factors. And not to steal his thunder, I'm going to ask Dr. Revelle to give a brief summary of what you found in our backshore characterization analysis. Thank you.
Thank you, Chandra. Good evening, commissioners. So I've been working with the city now since about September on various aspects of this. The first stage is really is to develop this backshore characterization. And there's a lot of regional initiatives going on right now across Santa Barbara County. One of them is a modeling of future coastal erosion, coastal flood hazards from Holama down to Rincon. And so part of the work that I've been doing with the city is actually collecting some site-specific data on extensive structures, how high these structures are, what kind of condition they're in, how high are the bluffs, what kind of condition are those in, so that that information, which forms this backshore characterization, which is the geology, the geomorphology, or the actual shapes, so how high are the cliffs, what are the shapes of the beach, how wide are the beaches, that all is feeding into the modeling that's going on right now that is set to finish countywide in late May, early June at present. So we're using sort of the best available models and applying really site-specific within the city jurisdictional field data collection and geology to look at some of the factors that could exacerbate coastal hazards in the city. One of those is cliff erosion. Most of the city's exposure on the open coast, which is exposed to wave energy, is driven from, it comes from the cliff erosion. And a lot of it is the open space, which is fortunate. We don't have a lot of too much oil and gas development still on the top of the bluffs. There's certainly a lot along the beach, the back of the beach, which is altering the city's beaches to some extent. We've looked at the variability in erosion. Erosion doesn't happen on an average annual sense, but that's what setback laws, regulations, and policies are often based on. And so we've looked at historic shoreline changes through this, which range from 1.5 inches a year to 27 inches a year. That's not to say that a 1 inch hazard, 1 year hazard zone is only 1.5 inches. We can see a big failure within the geology that could create more problems for Sandpiper, Bacara, some of these other locations within the city. So we're taking a very fine-tuned approach to the modeling that will support using field data collection within the city to sort of provide a parcel level analysis.
All right, thank you. And again, we talked about this last time. The impacted areas and infrastructure within the city of Goleta range from the sanitary district pipe infrastructure, obviously the Bacara, Sandpiper, Haskell's in terms of beach access, the commercial area within Old Town, some residential areas, Southwest and Stork Ranch, our non-conforming oil facility, and remnants of onshore oil and gas facilities along the shoreline. So that's where we are today. We've completed that study. So prior to us beginning the actual vulnerability assessment in like the time frame that Dave mentioned, probably May, June, because we're waiting for the county to wrap up their modeling effort, and then we will piggyback off that because we're strong believer in collaboration and using other people's data, you might as well, to save us time and money. In the meantime, we thought we'd take this opportunity to provide a overview, information kind of for our planning commission and whoever else on just general planning regulatory tools in terms of policies and regulations that we're seeing across the state for addressing sea level rise and coastal hazards. And let me just state, this isn't something, all of these aren't the things we're gonna do. It's just something that we're looking at and something to keep in mind so that going forward, we are all informed decision makers, both staff, our consultants, our decision makers, on what are the possibilities, what are the options, what are the tools that we have before us. And fortunately, there's a plethora of great tools out there from a planning perspective to address these issues and these coastal hazards. So today I'm just going to provide a, a broad overview, and then we'll come back to you in the coming months as we have more information and tell you kind of where we're at with the actual specific policies and regulations. So let's start off with some exciting planning tools. The first one is the California Coastal Act, which oversees, well, I shouldn't say this, it works in conjunction with the California Coastal Commission, and it kind of is the background for our local coastal program. The next one is the Public Trust Doctrine, and that itself, and I'll read the definition for you just so that I get it correct legally. Places a duty upon the local trustees, which is us, to manage coastal resources, including tidelands and surface waters, for the benefit of the state's citizens, which sounds pleasant. The next one is the Constitutional Takings Doctrine, which is related to property takings, something that we should all be aware of, under which certain adaptation strategies that impair private rights, property rights, may be vulnerable to adverse judicial ruling, so something to keep in mind. And then my favorite, and probably yours, is CEQA, and probably needs no introduction since you've dealt with it, but it's there. So we'll move forward and talk about how all these planning tools come to bear when we're looking at coastal hazards. Let's start off with the California Coastal Act. I'm going to quote some sections, just something to keep in mind as to why are we doing all this. The first one is section 30235, provide for the maximum protection of public beach and recreational resources in all coastal planning and regulatory decisions. And not to worry, we are doing that in our LCP. In addition to that, we've been provided actual draft sea level rise policy guidance, draft, I should say, from the Coastal Commission. And in that, it states, in addition to the current LCP requirements, because there are a few, two types of updates will be necessary to address sea level rise. Policies, in the way of general land use planning, and ordinances, which could be zoning, that apply to all development exposed to sea level rise, and policies and land use changes to address these specific risks. In that vein, the California Coastal Commission has given suggested measures, so again, something to keep in mind, and I mean, none of these look foreign to us. Most of them are what are considered good planning, and fortunately for all of us, a lot of this is already in our general plan because they gave it a lot of thought and put all of this in. For example, preserving open space, transfer development rights, else? Design standards. A lot of this is already in our general plan. What we are missing, and something we're going to dive into more, is hazard zoning and overlay zoning. So it's something that we will be working with Dave this summer in the vulnerability assessment. It's actually setting up a hazard overlay and figuring out where do these coastal hazards come into play, what can we do, and so on. So more information to come. Now, let's talk about the sticky stuff, the public trust doctrine, the property takings. And again, just something to keep in mind when looking at these types of issues in the context of sea level rise. And with sea level rise, typically, the mean high tide line will change in some cases. Therefore, as it rises, therefore, of course, the wet sand will move upwards along the beach. And it's the wet sand that is within the public trust doctrine. So as the mean high tide moves, the wet sand moves, the public trust doctrine jurisdiction moves. So this, yes, I just said that, increases the land entrusted to the state on the public's behalf. So keeping that in mind, obviously, governments are concerned with the legal implications of property rights, i.e. takings, in attempting to adapt to sea level rise, for instance, transfer development rights, manage retreat, what have you. However, as if that's not complicated enough, Municipalities also need to understand the importance of addressing sea level rise because they can be held responsible for not doing so, which then is the violation of the public trust doctrine. So there are a lot of moving targets. We don't have the answers yet, but we will research this further and at least know that we are trying to do our best to be informed about all these different kind of legal issues and so on as we move forward. Of course, working in conjunction with our city attorney and everyone else. So on that note, let's go to CEQA, which is, it's just, you know, it's my favorite, actually. So it's there in our CEQA guidelines, which are handy every time you need it. An EIR shall analyze any significant environmental effects the project might cause by bringing development and people into the area affected. This, in the case, would be sea level rise. Further, an EIR should evaluate any potential significant impacts of locating development in other areas susceptible to hazardous conditions. It could be floodplains, coastlines, wildfire risk areas, you name it, as identified as authoritative hazard maps, which we do not have right now, but something we're going to develop, risk assessments, or in land use plans addressing such hazard areas. So by doing all of this, this will help us become more informed for purposes of CEQA. And that will help the development community. It will help us as decision makers, staff, everyone. It'll be good. So with all that in mind, let's move on to zoning and regulations. So I'm just going to provide, again, a very broad kind of overview. What are some potential zoning regulations that we're seeing other communities put in place to address the issue of coastal hazard sea level rise? And obviously I did not come up with these myself. They came from the Adaptation Toolkit for Sea Level Rise and Coastal Land Use. So we mentioned before zoning and overlay zones, floodplain regulations, various building codes, setbacks, buffers, conditional development and extractions, rebuilding restrictions, subdivisions, hard armoring, soft armoring, and then, of course, rolling coastal management, rolling easement statutes. So there's a lot there, and just know that we have a lot in our toolbox that we could look at. Again, I'm not saying we're going to do any of these or some of these, but it's just knowing that we do have these options out there. And not but least, it is important to recognize that the zoning has to be combined with some type of spending or market-based tools, like capital improvement programs, which we already have in place now, CIPs, possibility of acquisitions, conservation easements, tax and other development incentives, transferable development credits, and real estate disclosures. Real estate disclosures are interesting in that it's something that you could tie to the property, making sure they're informed and aware of whatever hazard it may be. Maybe sea level, flood, what have you. Again, making sure they're disclosed at the time of sale. That's just, again, an example of some of these tools. So we'll just go to transfer development rights only because this is already called out in our general plan and we have a place saver in our zoning. So a TDR program would involve, again, zoning that allows a property owner, say in this example, in a sea level rise exposure zone to sell the right to develop the property to another property owner in a preferred development zone. So really, the goal is to ensure that said property remains undeveloped because it's in, say, a hazardous location, sea level rise, what have you, flood. Therefore, that said property owner must execute a permanent conservation easement at the time of sale. We've seen this in other areas and other jurisdictions for agriculture, certain types of wetlands, habitat. So this concept isn't exactly a new one, but we'll just be applying it in these certain instances, flooding, what have you. So something, again, is an option to have there. So I'm going to wrap up with a quick case study that actually Dr. Ravel did, conveniently, erosion mitigation alternatives. It was addressed in the Southern Monterey Bay report. They looked at a variety, actually, of policy and zoning regulations. It was quite lengthy and quite impressive. So it was good to know that an area was looking at this here in California. And let me just state that, you know, Monterey Bay definitely has different conditions than we do. We're very fortunate in that it's not immediately in our face, whereas in Southern Monterey, they are in the high wave zone. I'll let Dave get into the details, but it was something that they needed to address now. So we're fortunate that we can see and learn from their lessons learned for our own community. And again, that's why it's important to see what other communities are doing. So in their case, rolling easements were found to be the best for the critical erosion areas, and the transfer of development right credits seemed to be the preferred method overall. And if you have any detailed questions about this report, not only will we post this and all the other reports you've seen cited on our website, but you can ask Dr. Ravel as well. Well, enough of that. So lots of choices out there in terms of policies and zoning and land use. But again, we're fortunate as planners and as a community to have a toolbox to choose from as we go further along this journey. So speaking of this journey, what are the next steps for our local coastal program? As I've mentioned before, the next step is our vulnerability assessment, which we hope to kick off in June with Dr. Ravel. It allows us to continue to be consistent with various coastal acts sections. We're going to be utilizing the modeling results from the county's project, and we will, of course, be consistent with Coastal Commission draft policy. In addition to looking at sea level rise, I do want to point out that we're also going to be looking at other climate change impacts outside of sea level, such as increased temperature and fire hazards within Elwood Mesa, changes in precipitation, longer droughts, all those things that I mentioned in that earlier slide of coastal hazards, because it's not, unfortunately, just sea level rise. So as a result, we're going to do some hazard mapping. So we're going to have some a hazard overlay, and then we're looking at identified resources by planning horizon. And again, this is all draft, hasn't been decided, but something around 2030, 2050, 2100, those are pretty typical. Different sea level rise scenarios, high, medium, low. And in addition to that, we're going to develop, Dr. Ravel, metric summary tables, number of parcels, acres of habitat, all sorts of great information, because we really need to have information and data before we make any kind of decision, any kind of approach, you know, in terms of planning. So from a policy and regulatory standpoint. And that's it. So here are our contacts. And as always, I highly encourage you to visit our website. There's just a continuing amount of good information on there. So, and I am available, as is the team, with any, for any questions. And thank you again for your time.
Chair?
Mr. Daniels.
Thank you. Good job again. Thank you. Doctor, can you explain rolling easements, please?
A rolling easement is, it's basically, you're probably familiar, I mean, I guess in the easiest way to explain it is right now we sort of have everything below mean high water is the sort of property boundary line between public and private properties. A rolling easement could be an easement that is acquired that instead of it being at almost 5 feet right now, the city could acquire, say, up to 10 feet, or an area that would allow the coastal processes to operate, maintaining our beaches and maintaining some of the coastal resources that would have naturally have evolved without the use of, say, hardened structures or other loss of other resources. So A rolling easement is really a policy tool that allows, that buys the purchases, provides an easement for the coastal processes to occur. It could occur in Goleta Slough, where again that same private property boundary line is determined by mean high water. And mean high water is kind of an interesting one because everything's built next to mean high water, but as long as sea level's been rising or falling, mean has, which is the average of 19 years of tides, changes too. So 7,000 years ago was 120 feet farther west. So mean is a bit, it's an ambulatory line anyway, and so rolling easement is allowing that line to migrate based on natural processes. And there's a variety of ways to acquire those easements.
Got it. It's similar to creek center lines and the fact that they get readjusted every once in a while too, and that necessarily would actually be on a grant deed, you know, because I'm guessing you've done some stream research or river research, you know, and seen this kind of stuff, and I think I have a better understanding of it now. So thank you.
Commissioner Jenkins?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thanks for the presentation. Ms. Slavin or Dr. Revelle, on slide number 7 is showing the back shore characterization, and you've got 3 different timelines. You've got 2025 in 10 years, 2050 in 35 years, 2100 in 75 years. And given the 1.5 inches per year up to 27 inches per year, what type of scale, worst and best case, are we talking about? Are we talking hundreds of yards, 2 feet? What? Give me an idea what those lines might be as a scale.
So that, first of all, this graphic was sort of taken from a different place. It's sort of representative of some of the modeling approaches that we're using at the county, but this is not sort of necessarily for this particular application. That is really what's going to be coming out of the vulnerability assessment. The modeling results are just starting to roll in. We had a workshop last month sort of unveiling the first draft results for the modeling for the South Coast. And that is work that we're sort of amending right now, and then we'll be running through multiple sea level rise scenarios, looking at different elevations. We're going to be incorporating tectonics or vertical uplift. Many of the cliffs in Goleta are rising faster are rising. And so as sea level rises and the cliffs rise, sea level is still rising faster than the cliffs, but in order to look at what that means into the future, you have to take into account the vertical land motion or subsidence, as we'd see in Goleta Slough or downtown Santa Barbara. Those areas are falling, so sea level there will be more than what is projected at a global basis. So all of the modeling that we're doing right now for the county, which is again sort of been additionally fine-tuned for Goleta, will take into account those regional differences of the Elwood Mesa and Hope Ranch and Gaviota and, you know, sort of subsections. But there's definitely a couple of different sections here in Goleta that will look at the changes in what we call relative sea level rise, which is the global average plus the vertical land motion, either up for uplift or down for subsidence.
Thank you. I'm heading to a certain destination here, but geology, the geology on our bluffs, is it consistent in Goleta, or does it vary a lot?
It varies some. It's not as varied. The geology in Santa Barbara South Coast is amazing. It changes everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so the modeling, really we're getting at sort of the backshore characterization that we've taken is we've sort of attributed or identified what areas on the South Coast are a cliff-backed inlet-backed, dune-backed, coastal armored-backed, and then what are the similarities in geology? And we sort of break the coast up based on backshore type, geology, and then we take a lot of statistics of historic erosion rates, measures of beach slope, beach width, cliff erosion rate, so that we can then use those to feed into the model. So the backshore characterization leads into the modeling inputs, mm-hmm. and those model inputs will then, outputs, when those are completed in May, will then feed into the vulnerability assessment. What's in those hazard zones, and you know, things may be in a hazard zone, but they may not be hazardous because of design standards, or you know, you can picture the houses built on stilts on the barrier islands on the Gulf Coast. Those are some types of design construction standards that we can look at potentially. That might be an extreme example, but we can look at some of those types of strategies in the adaptation phase.
Here's where I'm headed, and that is, as an architect, I've dealt with a couple of bluff properties in the city of Santa Barbara, okay, where, you know, on Shoreline Drive, you've got a lot of development along there. City of Goleta, we don't have that at this time, but, you know, you mentioned Sandpiper. Also, there's properties, I don't know if properties, you know, at the east end of Phelps or, you know, up by the Goleta Slough, if any of those properties would be affected as far as erosion. You know, I know it's, you're talking wetlands at that point, you're not talking bluffs, but let's take Sandpiper for an example. If they wanted to build something, okay, another clubhouse or something, I'm just throwing out just to give me something to grapple with, they would have to determine where that bluff is going to erode to in 75 years. It's historically, you know, the burden of proof that we have to come up with as designers. We'd have to hire a geologist to determine where that bluff is going to erode to in 75 years. If that erosion point is to a point where it's splitting your property in half, you can't develop anything on the ocean side of that setback. The end product of your study and the analysis that the city of Goleta is going to have, is that going to provide data that a developer doesn't have to then hire a geologist? Can we rely on the information that you guys come up with on this? Or is it, we'll still have to do a case-by-case, property-by-property, and the Sandpiper would have to hire a geologist?
That's an excellent question. I think we're going to have to, that is to be determined. I'm going to have to dive into some of the details. Dave and I just put together this scope of work, recognizing that this was something we needed. To kind of give you a background, when we initially started the LCP, there isn't clear guidance, unfortunately, to the level of detail one is needed to do to really address these issues and to answer those questions, because I gave a presentation at the Goleta Chamber of Commerce recently, and they asked the same question, and it was excellent, and I couldn't answer it. And so I immediately called up Dave, and I said, we need to answer this. And then we found out the results that we'd get at the county, and it wasn't detailed enough to answer. So I went to Ann, and bless her heart, she said, we can do this, and we've got the funding. And I said, excellent, because I want to be able to answer those questions. So now we're getting into the details to figure out what level of analysis, how much budget will be necessary to answer those questions for the city of Goleta, not for the Coastal Commission, not for our LCP, but for the city of Goleta. And we'll be able to get you that, tell you if we can answer that soon. So thank you for your patience, because we realized that it wasn't what the LCP required. It wasn't to this level of detail.
If I may, the science is evolving, and the planners are kind of at the tail end. You know, we're trying to always catch up to the scientists, and so we're, you know, we're picking up the pieces and then going, oh, well, I guess we need to learn about that too and study that too because that's important. And they're like, the scientists are going, I know, that's what we told you. And so there's, you know, sometimes people ask questions, we're like, ah, and that puts it in the context. And it doesn't mean that we'll be able to answer that direct question of now we won't need to hire a geologist because we don't know what kind of state requirements there'll be for construction, for example. But at least we'll have more information. At least we'll have more real data to work with. We'll have more facts at a parcel level. And that, I think, will help guide us in and help guide our local landowners. And we're fortunate that we don't have a ton of properties that are along the shore. So it's something that we can put our hands around. So we think it's a fair way to move forward.
Mr. Chair, just by matter of just my own personal opinion on this, I think for the city to produce a document that is kind of broad brush stroke that gives us a clue, an idea where Samaria's may be. But it seems to me that if, let's say, the Sandpiper had wanted to do a development, the burden should be on them, you know, because it's site specific. And so it seems to me that the geologist should still be hired. So it just seems to me that's the, you know, the best avenue. So I think what you're coming up with is a good tool and, you know, and representing the public trust and all that, but the burden is still on the developer.
Yes, I would say, and then Dave will add, our goal is to hopefully find somewhat of middle ground between just kind of that high level that Coastal Commission initially, and I you know, like Ann said, they're trying to go that direction to also the needs of Goleta, but we can only do so much. And so I think Dave can kind of...
Well, and how do we develop the planning tools? How do we know we have the right planning tools if we don't know what those resources are? Mm-hmm. So it's getting down to that right level of science to be able to justify the planning resources.
And I can add a couple, my perspective from working on sort of coastal hazard modeling up and down the West Coast. It's a lot of it comes down to how the jurisdiction wants to implement it. The data will be at a sufficient level that will help you guys evaluate planning decisions that have to be made. These hazard zones will be shown on a map. They'll show cliff erosion extents. They'll show the airport underwater. It'll show a lot of different things. Part of Stork Ranch is underwater under the high sea level rise. So there's some places within the city that these are going to be hazard zones, hazard overlays. How the city chooses to implement that and adopt policies and language and ordinances around those is really the local decision context. It's important that the staff and the city has this a regional approach that's been applied systematically using the best science. But that same hazard zone that's been identified from the model outputs, I've seen it applied as a setback line. I've seen it replied as a geologic report trigger. If you're in here and you want to do anything else, you have to answer these additional stringent geologic report requirements. So there's several different ways that you guys can implement the hazard overlays. Some jurisdictions are contemplating saying that if the coastal hazard extends beyond the coastal zone, into other parts of their jurisdiction, that they're going to use similar coastal zone standards. So there's a lot of different ways that can be done, and we're really just starting that process. But the hope is that the hazard overlays will be used to identify what's in those hazard zones and what's likely to be at risk, and then what mechanisms and techniques can be used from a planning or engineering standpoint that can lower those risks and start to adapt. One other piece I want to add is that there is in the Coastal Commission guidance for this type of modeling to be included in updates for the LCP. There's a parallel tract in the draft guidance that requires every coastal development permit applicant to do this same level of analysis. Mm-hmm. So in one sense, it will streamline things for a lot of the development community if they like the results. If they don't like the results, they can go hire a local geologist to get as much detail, and they can go back and forth. And that will take some understanding of the nuances that have gone into those hazard projections compared to some of the site specifics that may not have been able to be included in a more regional model.
Last question, I hope is an easy one. On slide 21, there's an acronym TOD credits. What does TOD stand for?
Transfer development.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Commissioners, any other questions?
Hopefully this is pretty simple. I was just curious on the methodology of determining the rate of retreat of the bluffs and also how that compares in other parts of the state.
That's not an easy answer. The short answer is the modeling approach we're taking here in the cliffs is looking at the historic trends of erosion and then looking at the hours of wave attack that are responsible for determining that cliff erosion rate. And then as sea level comes up and those hours of wave attack increase, the erosion rates accelerate.
So for the historical data, what did you use for?
We had a variety of different shorelines, work that's been done by the USGS, work I actually did for my dissertation work while along here. And so for the city, we've actually extracted multiple short cliff edges and used those to calculate long-term rates.
From
geospatial analysis.
All right. And how far back does that data go that you?
I think the first shoreline cliff edge that we used was 1859.
Okay.
Yeah. Chair,
thank you.
Chair, I want to have a few.
Might have been 1871.
I don't remember exactly. So first I just wanted to make a comment that I am really excited about the work that you're doing and impressed by your presentation today. And I'd also like to see in the vulnerability study a careful look at the slough. I know you mentioned briefly about Stork Ranch as being a potentially an area that could quite significantly be affected. I've looked at a number of sea level maps online, and one of the things that shocked me when I first looked at it is I expected to see a lot of effects right along the coastline, and it took me a step back to notice how much of the effects were actually inland, because it's really where the sloughs and the rivers are that are having the most effect. So I expect to see around Goleta Slough to be our biggest problem area. You mentioned armored, both hard and soft armored areas along the coastline. And if we do go into considering those options, I'd also like to see an option for managed retreat and to see that considered. There was, with the transfer of rights, I have a question on that. So I'm a bit new to the Planning Commission, so please humor me here. But you were talking about that if somebody had the right to develop along the coastline, they could transfer that to another area. What sort of areas do you see them transferring those rights to in Goleta?
Actually, I would think we would, well, again, I'll look to Dave, but in other areas I've seen you, the goal is to try to stay within the coastal zone, mm-hmm. but that may, you know, since our coastal zone is not very large, we may have to be flexible on mm-hmm. that, and that's something that we're going to flesh out per what we already have in our general plan right now, because mm-hmm. we want to make sure we're consistent with the stuff that's already there. This is something that we're working through, and we should have a better idea. Dave, what have you seen in your past experience?
With transfer development rights, a lot of times what I see is that there's clearly not a lot of unhazardous oceanfront properties. And so often the relocation would be inland mm-hmm. and come with an increased density of development or mm-hmm. some other sort of carrot to mm-hmm. make it more enticing. One wonderful example that I think everybody would agree is a wonderful example mm-hmm. of a TDR program, Transfer Development Right program, and that's the Big Sur Coast, the Highway 1 scenic mm-hmm. route. Most of the oceanfront properties, that they've had that program in place for decades, and mm-hmm. they've transferred much of the development to the inland side of Highway 1, mm-hmm. and that's been a very successful one. There are other cases in the East Coast, Pine Barrens mm-hmm. in New Jersey is another very successful one. And they have, that was a much more complicated one that included multiple jurisdictions, and then you get into who pays for emergency services and all of that. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's going to be that complicated here, but it's possible. But I guess what I'm trying to say is there's, again, it comes down to the specifics of the implementation. It's been done elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Densification and development inland is often the easiest answer.
And who would determine what those carrots and incentives might be? Would that be Planning Commission, City Council, or would that be, which groups would decide that?
Those are our regulatory tools, and we're working on those.
Okay.
But in the decision tree, it would be Planning Commission would recommend, Council would decide.
Okay, thank you. Okay, then one last question. You mentioned that this will not only look at sea level rise, but other impacts of climate change in the region. And so I have a couple questions about what might also be addressed. So for instance, we have a wonderful agricultural community here and many urban farms that we're very proud of. Will you be looking at climate change's effect on what can be grown here and productivity of our farms?
At this stage, no, because there is no agricultural land in the coastal zone.
Okay, so it's only coastal zone.
Yeah, at this stage, yes. Our focus is the local coastal program, and within that, it is the coastal zone. Okay. That's not to say in the future, mm-hmm. we as a city will decide to expand that mm-hmm. scope and look at the city overall. And that's something that we can discuss later.
Okay. And one last question related to that one. Will you also be looking at how climate change may affect some of the species of insects or animals or birds in our protected areas along the coastline, and whether they may still be able to have habitat in those regions with the climate change?
Dave, actually, can you answer something?
There wasn't a lot of consideration about species-specific migrations. Mm-hmm. A lot of that science is very... very uncertain. Mm-hmm. There has been some look within Goleta Slough as mm-hmm. part of a larger Goleta Slough mm-hmm. Effort to look at how habitats may change mm-hmm. through time in the wetlands. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing, we're not looking at any, currently looking at any of the specifics there. Mm-hmm. It's a really nuanced, the uncertainties in a lot of the climate change parameters are really broad.
I can add that at UCSB, the Endeavro Slough, they're gearing up to do some studies where they're looking at salinities mm-hmm. so they can see if there are salinity changes that alters the transition of habitats from a more freshwater to a more mm-hmm. saline condition, and then if that affects how the saline conditions alter the wetland habitat types as it migrates up the creek mm-hmm. And affects the creek habitats, which go mm-hmm. up into Goleta. So we're in communication, and they just let me know their the results of their studies. But these are long-term studies, so.
Okay. Thank you very much for your additional clarifications.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Sorry. Just a follow-up question. Mr. Revelle, you mentioned about Stork Ranch possibly being underwater in spots, and that can be very troubling to the general public. Is that in areas there's currently development that would be underwater, or is that in just some of the wetland areas that are adjacent to Stork Ranch?
The initial modeling results show that part of the development in Stork Ranch could be flooded at 2100 with about 5 feet of sea level rise. Now, I've done a lot of hazard mapping, and I hate to be referred to as Dr. Gloom. I'd like to come in and say, look, this is what could be at risk, but here are five different things we could do to reduce that risk and those vulnerabilities. And one of the biggest questions outstanding about Goleta Slough is how we're going to how the mouth management of Goleta Slough is going to play out.
Okay.
If that is required to be closed by the regulatory agencies, then the airport, Old Town, Stork Ranch, there's going to be a lot of problems. depending upon the management of the inlet mouth, that may be something that won't have to be dealt with for an extra 100 years. Storms will still happen. There will still be flooding problems. They will get worse over time, and sea level will not stop at 2100. 3,000, 20, you know, 3,100, perhaps. But we've got a lot of turning of a big global ship around before we get there.
Sure. Are we, you mentioned TDR as one tool. Are we looking at other possibilities? I mean, are we learning from, say, New Orleans? Are we talking levees in some locations as an option or no?
I mean, we're not there yet. The way I've, the way I'm approaching this vulnerability assessment is, let's look at the specifics of what falls into those hazard zones, and then look at it by sector. You know, there'll be public infrastructure, transportation, you know, natural resources, and then what are the adaptation strategies that could be applied to each of those sectors? Some of them may be very beneficial for one sector and destroy another. So those aren't good ones. So we have to look at the cross-pollinization and figure out which multi-objective strategies can, you know, be blended together to come up with the most rational solution.
And that's why we have a number of touch points with you, so that we can, you know, fill you in along the way, and as we make progress, we're having these touch points. And why we made the extra commitment, when the Chamber of Commerce asked the question, and as we are, the planners are learning, we realize that investment in the additional analyses and studies are necessary, because we do really need to understand, and whatever maps we do bring to you, we need to be able to be sure that they're not based on some, you know, large scale, broad, you know, globalization data. That it's been refined down, so we're not trying to get down to somebody's parcel and do their work for them. We need to know that if we're projecting something out, because that is what the Coastal Commission is telling us that we have to do, that we're doing it as accurately as we can in a reasonable way, and then we can start talking about planning tools.
If I can just summarize again, this just all points to how important it is to plan ahead, and why we're coming to you at this early stage with information we've collected with Dr. Dave Revell, and just letting you know that it isn't all gloom, that, yeah, by planning ahead, we do have options and adaptation strategies. And we're fortunate that there is the ability to get down to Goleta's scale, but again, not to level. So it's a very, very exciting time right now. So again, thank you for letting us share all this.
I'd like to ask a couple questions.
Yes.
So under infrastructure, Goleta Sanitary District's pipe infrastructure, what are we talking about specifically there? Goleta Beach or in the Elwood area, or what pipelines are we talking about?
The specific vulnerabilities in the city of Goleta are in Devereaux Creek and the restoration area Ocean Meadows Golf Course. The specific components that are vulnerable in Goleta West are, the pipes can be underwater, that's fine. It's the pump stations that we're worried about. And in the Placentia neighborhood, and that kind of odd amorphous area, we'll call it, there's some adaptation strategies that could potentially reduce some of the flooding, because right now there's backwatering coming up during high stormwater events. And so there's some simple things like putting gaskets on the manhole covers and things like that that can be done. So when we start looking at adaptation strategies, there will be ones that will work for 6 inches of sea level rise and some that might work for 6 feet. And so that'll be part of that identification process.
Another question. So when we're talking about hazards, I didn't hear anybody bring up tsunamis. And that was the communication in the South Coast here several years back. Are we satisfied with our tsunami analysis, or is this going to be updated?
So we have tsunami policies and we have a tsunami hazard map, and that's handed to us. So we're given a tsunami.
From the state?
Yeah. Or is it USGS?
California Geologic Survey, if you're using the 2009 modeling?
I believe so. So they tell us to plan for tsunamis, and then we have an evacuation zone and an evacuation plan that's addressed in our county hazard.
Multi-hazard jurisdiction plan.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so all counties have to have this.
Mm-hmm.
And so we work as a county with this regional planning tool for evacuations for tsunami, but it's different than the sea level rise, and I don't know how they'll project that out, but I think they update it on a regular basis, so they're not looking out to 2100, for example. They're looking like real time, like in the next 2 years.
Mm-hmm. It's considered outside of the scope of this particular project. That's not to downplay the importance of tsunamis, but we feel at this time, upon the review of the general plan, the information that we do get from the state is adequate and it is therefore not needed. We're focused more on sea level rise, drought, flood inundation, and fire hazards. Yeah, those are the areas that need greater attention at this time in terms of developing a hazards overlay for purposes of the LCP.
Well, those are my only questions. I'm not going to turn it back to the commission to ask more questions. So thank you very much.
Can I ask a question? Is that really out of line?
Go ahead, Dr. Rebecca.
So one of the things I've worked with a lot of jurisdictions, and one of the first questions that often comes up in the vulnerability assessment is, what are some of the best metrics to report these vulnerabilities? Is it miles of road? Is it miles of pipe? Is it number of bus stops? Is it traffic trips? Is it, you know, manhole covers? Or is it dollars? How many, you know, built environment, how much, you know, improved land values, how many buildings versus parcels? Some of those metrics are really helpful to try and understand going forward what would be the most useful for the city.
And we can obtain that information going forward. I'll work with Anne to get that information for you, because that is important questions as we go further with your scope of work. And so we'll be following up with you as well as council and others.
Commissioner Maynard.
Thank you, Chair Onan. I would have one response. I would be, the spatial data is probably the most important to me, more so than the bottom line. I'd like to know what communities are affected, to be able to think through how those communities would deal with the potential flooding risks. Are these neighborhoods that are likely to be able to rebuild or not? What sort of support are they going to need if they need to rebuild in a flood situation? What would it mean to have to relocate somebody if they needed to be? So I think the spatial data is most important to me, because that would help me understand how the community would be most affected.
Obviously, I think we could have a debate on that right now. But I mean, when you're talking about mitigation measures and protective things and the cost of implementing those, obviously, what are you protecting? What are the values that you are protecting? And how do those costs then flow to them? As a business person, I'm sorry, I'm looking at numbers. So there would obviously be a lot of discussion about what the metric should be, but I understand the importance of them. So we'll probably have some vigorous debate on that in the months to come.
Sure.
Yes.
If I may, I think all metrics are important.
We will be following up with
do
a questionnaire.
Do them all.
All righty.
Yeah.
Okay, staff, thank you so much. And Ms. Slavin, thank you for your enthusiastic presentation.
My
you
pleasure.
Kept us fully engaged.
That's my goal.
Let's move on to the director's report.
I can't promise the same type of engagement, but I'll try. So first off, you might have known we have a missing person over here. Winnie had her baby on March 31st, baby girl named Eleanor, and she'll be out for some time. Tim Giles and or Carl Berger will be subbing in. Tim was going to be here tonight, but because it was a presentation, I told him he could have the night off. Last meeting, we were asked about whether or not there would be meetings through June, and there will be. So we have another meeting in April, only one meeting in March, or in May, sorry, and then two meetings in June. So we will, we don't have the items set absolutely yet, but we can, we will not, I don't believe in wasting the commission's time, so we won't bring you in for just, hey, how you doing? Okay, bye. So, but we'll let you know what type of items we have as things move forward. Some other upcoming items that you will be seeing this summer is Old Town Village, as well as the draft one day, we're getting there, we'll come out on the zoning ordinance and we'll start review of that as well. The next meeting in April will be our CIP, and we'll try and also provide some other information for you at that meeting. One item of note is the Hagen conversion that everyone is talking about. Our local Vaughn stores, the Goleta conversion will be happening next week. It was supposed to start on Friday. They pushed it to Monday, or the 19th, and then the store will reopen on the 20th. Other stores in the area have been postponed until June. That said, the sign for Hagen will be at the DRB on Wednesday, so you never know. They could end up with a postponement if that doesn't go well. I'm sure it will, though. And then at our last council meeting, we did a session on landscape deferrals because we were asked by the Goleta Water District to consider deferring all landscaping until a future date with different projects that are coming through to address some of the water crises that we're dealing with. The executive order was also discussed at that meeting. And what we're seeing is new rules are coming fast and furious down the chain from the state agencies. We actually had the Goleta Water District got their overall reduction goal about an hour before the meeting. So we're in the 20%. While it's 25% across the state, Goleta Water has been asked to reduce another 20%. And the executive order says September of 2013, it's actually 20% from September 2014. And so we should be hearing more as things come down from all the different agencies that are involved in the executive order. I expect the Regional Water Quality Board will also have some major rules coming down. And as those are coming across our desks, we will make sure to let you know and what we expect, how they will affect all the development that's been approved and is under construction or pending across the city. It's going to be a very interesting time. We don't expect that applications will need to come back to you. There may be landscaping plans that need to go back to DRB. We're investigating different strategies to address a delay, whether it's extending bonds, separate agreements, what we need to do for landscaping issues, and we'll be bringing back that item to council at a later date, but fairly soon. I'm looking at Lisa. So other than that, that's everything on my list. I'm available for questions if anyone has any.
Well, I've got something that I'm going to push you on a little bit. I think we need to set the commission calendar for July and August.
Okay.
In coordination, if it's important or not to be in coordination with the city council, because those are vacation timelines.
Right.
And if we're going to not have a meeting, let's set it.
Okay.
So that people can plan a break now if they're planning.
We can certainly do that. At the last meeting, you requested through June. So we will bring back July and August at the next meeting.
I'll make it. Yeah, it's good. Okay. So, yeah, let's push it now to July and August.
You got it.
And I think the city council has a couple dark
yes, they do.
Weeks in there, it's important for us or not.
Well, we hadn't decided to adhere to the council schedule because we were anticipating hearings starting on the ordinance as it comes out in draft form. I'm not sure of the schedule at this time, but we will let you know, and we can go dark with their schedule depending on where we are with the ordinance.
Okay. So now we go to commissioners. Comments or observations? Commissioner Maynard.
Thank you, Chair Onan. I just wanted to mention briefly that I attended the Coastal Housing Coalition's Affordable Housing Conference last Friday. I heard an excellent presentation by Ms. Ann Wells on workforce housing here in Goleta, and was very proud of Ann for all of her work and her presentation there. it was wonderful to be able to connect with the community, to learn about these issues that are affecting our community. And especially, they presented a lot of wonderful data on the effect of the lack of affordable housing on local businesses and really what it means for local businesses in terms of recruitment opportunities and being able to keep keep workers regionally. So I was it was wonderful to be able to have the chance to be there.
Thank you. Commissioner Daniels?
Negative.
Commissioner Fuller?
Yeah, I just want to comment. I was at that meeting also, and it was very good. Anne did do a great presentation as well. So thank you, Anne, for representing the city.
Commissioner Jenkins.
Yes, Mr. Chair. We had a great time at the, was it the League of Cities Planning Commissioner Academy is what it was called. And it was very informative. I kind of flip-flop between the beginning track and the advanced track, and it was very helpful as far as various seminars. Some of them will stick with me for a long time, particularly the ones on traffic and some of the tools they're using. I mean, pinging cell phones and getting information for how, you know, models are determined for arteries to different locations and what have you. So it's pretty interesting. The other one that was helpful was what to read in an EIR and what you can potentially avoid reading. so the real important, you know, deal killer ones. The presenters, that were, I would say the majority of them were just spot on and very engaging. There was only one in particular that I think I'd pass on if it was an opportunity in the future. But thank you for facilitating the commissioners to go, and it was very informative. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jenkins. Mr. Fuller, did that stir any memories in you?
It did, and I found it very valuable, the Planning Commissioners Academy as well, especially with regards to CEQA understanding and the scopes and just the involvement as well as reading it. And there was a lot there. It was really great. So I appreciate the city sending us and allowing us to participate in that.
Yeah, and I also got to attend that. And the change from level of service to what is it?
VMT.
VMT.
Vehicle miles traveled.
Right. And that's where I think you were talking about the cell phone data and the amazing data capability that will go into that. And I guess we'll all be migrating to this type of analysis and as a tool in the future. But that was very interesting. We talked to some communities brought forward some of their challenges regarding massage parlors and vacation rentals. So as a community, we're way ahead of the curve as far as vacation rentals are, and I think our regulation to massage parlors was ahead of the curve as well, but there's been some significant effects. Something that we should have some discussion that they had during the meeting or the academy was communication, and communication amongst the commissioners and staff, and how for that to occur most effectively and with the least burden, if you will. And I think there were some really good things to learn from that presentation. But as Mr. Jenkins says, they had the full scope. And we had planning professionals, commissioners, and city staff, yeah. Lawyers were there too?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I must have missed the lawyers. Although they were city attorneys for the most part. Oh, they're okay, yeah. So we're good with that. So I don't have any other comments. Anyone else?
I'd just like to note that the Chamber of Commerce sponsored an economic development tour of the city last week, and Commissioner Onan was one of the tour guides, and he did an excellent job leading a group of folks around the city. Actually, there were two buses, and he was in the first bus, so thank you. It was very fun.
Yeah, a lot of positive comments from that, so thank you. Any other comments? If not, I've been waiting to do this. Meeting adjourned.
just what it is. Who knows?